Northland Views for Wednesday, July 29th. Mark DeGroft with the Arid Sun Sounds of Arizona, first from the White Mountain Independent. A massive water bill could help Gila and Navajo counties. A key U.S. Senate committee has advanced a sprawling water infrastructure bill that would include money for some projects in Gila and Navajo counties. The Water Resources Department Act passed the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee on a bipartisan vote, according to a release from the office of Senator Mark Kelly. The sprawling bill would authorize some $35 billion in water infrastructure projects over the next 4 years. This includes some flood and water infrastructure projects in Gila and in Navajo counties, all of which have been inching through the federal approvals process for years now. Local projects included the reauthorization of the budget for the Army Corps of Engineers and the Bureau of Reclamation include, first off, the McCormick Wash Project, which will protect downtown Globe from flooding. The project was under study even before floodwaters last September jumped a debris-choked channel and inundated downtown Globe. The Federal Emergency Management Agency denied Gila County's plea for $100 million to repair damage from those floods. However, this didn't affect the separate effort to get help from the Army Corps of Engineers to create a diversion channel that would prevent floodwaters from jumping out of the existing channel in a narrow section that was created by the bridge. Secondly, the Winslow Levee Project in Navajo County would repair and extend the existing levee system that protects Winslow from flooding on the Little Colorado River. The estimated cost of the project has risen from the original $100 million to more like $140 million, which means the project needs additional funding just to complete detailed plans. This includes seeking engineering changes that could reduce the rising costs. Virtually all of Winslow is now at risk of flooding on the Little Colorado River. And the $1.8 million Navajo Nation Bird Springs Watershed Management Plan would protect four different watersheds on the reservation that feed into the Little Colorado River. The Navajo Nation signed an agreement with the feds to share the cost of the project back in 2017. Globe Mayor Al Gamero said, addressing McCormick Wash is critical to protecting residents, businesses, public infrastructure, and emergency access into the city of Globe from flooding while supporting long-term safety and economic vitality for the community. Senator Kelly understands the importance of investing in resilient infrastructure, and his continued advocacy for the city is making a real difference. Senator Kelly noted, Arizona knows better than most that water isn't something we can take for granted. As drought continues to strain the Colorado River and our communities keep growing, we have to make small investments now to secure our water future. This bipartisan bill helps communities modernize aging water systems, build new infrastructure, protect families from floods and wildfires, and move along delayed projects forward. The federal government and the Army Corps of Engineers remain key to the future of water infrastructure projects throughout the West. Those projects have become even more important as a result of the current decades-long drought, accompanied by the dramatic increase in catastrophic wildfires and flooding. The flood last year that devastated downtown Globe stemmed from debris flows off the burn scare of the Telegraph Fire. However, the combination of tax cuts, spending increases, and interest rate increases have driven record increase in the federal debt. The national debt hit $31.5 trillion in June of this year, compared to $22.3 trillion in June of 2021. This according to the Warren G. Peterson Foundation's deficit tracking website. That debt now exceeds the roughly $24 trillion gross domestic project, which is an estimate of the value of all goods and services that the economy produces in a year. The general election ballot for one Arizona Senate and two Arizona House seats in State Legislative District 7 will include some familiar faces. The strongly Republican district includes much of northern Arizona, including all of Gila and most of Navajo counties. In the Senate, Wendy Rogers faced no opposition in the Republican primary and none in the general election. In the House, Republican primary voters gave incumbent Walt Blackmun 35% of the vote, and former Representative David Cook 27% of all the votes that were cast. Blackmun and Cook defeated Andrew Costanzo, who got 21% of the vote, and Barbie Engle with 17%. Only one Democrat, Samuel Martin, ran for the two House seats. He's a teacher and deputy city clerk with 20 years' experience in technology, healthcare, and agriculture. Blackmun has one of his best records for getting bills through the legislature, according to the Arizona Agenda political newsletter. He served as the chair of the Judiciary Committee and now chairs the Government Committee. He's a decorated combat veteran, retiring as a sergeant after 21 years of service. He and his wife have five grown children. Marshall, a snowflake minister, a military veteran, opted not to run for re-election and accepted appointment as the Navajo County Recorder. This opened the door for Cook's comeback. Cook is a Globe rancher who previously served in the state legislature that represented District 7. He gave up his seat in an unsuccessful bid to challenge Rogers back in 2024. He was first elected to the House in 2016. He graduated from Miami High School, got a degree from Arizona State University, and worked for 12 years as a corrections officer. In the year 2000, he founded the D.C. Cattle Company. In the legislature, he took the lead on many rural and land use issues and service on the committees on commerce, land agriculture, and military affairs, public safety and transportation, this according to his Wikipedia profile. He was generally considered a moderate and pragmatic lawmaker, with a strong focus on rural land use areas. An online search revealed little posted information for Martin, the lone Democratic challenger. He answered a questionnaire on the Arizona Ballot Guide and wrote, "This year it's important to make the right choice for legislator. I'm the right choice for LD7. I know the real pitfalls and the potential of technologies like social media and AI. My opponents will believe any salesman who walks in the door. I will ensure health care across and access every Arizonan. My opponents will let you die in a gutter. I know the value of good public schools because I went to them. My opponents will never do anything for public education but tear it down. I am the only candidate who will stand up to the corruption, the cruelty, and the chaos coming from Washington, D.C. The choice is clear." During the July 21, 2026 primary election, poll workers at Heber Overgaard polling location discovered approximately 3,000 blank ballots from the 2024 general election. The ballots were found in shrink-wrap packages inside a storage tub that was in a closet at the county facility, which is used primarily as a Navajo County Sheriff's Office substation. The ballots remain unused and sealed in their shrink-wrap packages. They contain no voter selections, were never cast, and were never tabulated. They therefore did not affect any votes, tabulated results, or the outcome of any contest in the 2024 general election. And although the ballots have no effect on the election results, their discovery revealed a failure in the procedures that are used to account for and return unused ballots. Northland Pioneer College will hold auditions for the fall musical Finding Neverland from 5:30 to 10 p.m. on August 25th at the Performing Arts Center located on the Snowflake Taylor Silver Creek campus, and that's at 1611 South Main Street. Finding Neverland is based on the Academy Award-winning Miramax motion picture that was written by David McGee and the play The Man Who Was Peter Pan by Alan Nee. The production focuses on the playwright J.M. Barrie and the family that inspired Peter Pan, or The Boy Who Wouldn't Grow Up, featuring a book by James Graham with music and lyrics by Gary Barlow and Elliot Kennedy. Director and MPC faculty in theater and speech, Carson Saline, said, "Help us bring this unforgettable story to life. We're looking for actors and actresses ranging from 6 years to 60 plus. This is a musical, and the characters should have strong, charismatic personalities, be playful, and exhibit musical and movement ability. Auditions are open to everybody, not just current MPC students, and will consist of musical performances and a short dance movement call. A special slot for youth editions has been scheduled from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on for August 25th, at which time the production team will work with young casting hopefuls as a group. Additionally, youth participants should visit npc.edu/auditions to download and begin practicing two song cuts in preparation for the audition call. Other performers should become familiar with the cast characters and prepare two contrasting one-minute songs in the musical style of the show. Each cut should be no longer than 1 minute in length, and accompanists will be provided. For those who would like tips and tricks on how to prepare, what to prepare, musical choices, or need to shrug off nerves before auditions, a free workshop will be held at 6 o'clock p.m. on August 18th at NPC's Performing Arts Center. Everybody is welcome to attend. Appointments to audition must be made online at npc.edu/auditions. You can see the website for more information, including descriptions of the play's characters. Fall performances of Finding Neverland will be held from November 13th through the 21st at NPC's Performing Arts Center in Snowflake. For audition questions, you can call Celine at carson.celine@npc.edu. Better yet, call them 928-536-6247. 928-536-6247. Sounds like fun. And Vernon residents will have a full day to eat, play, shop, and spend time with their neighbors from 8 o'clock in the morning to 8 p.m. on August 1st, when the Vernon Day Celebration takes over Vernon Community Park. The celebration will also serve as a community fundraiser. Organizers say that the event is meant to celebrate Vernon's little corner, beautiful little corner of the world, while giving residents, friends, and neighbors a chance to enjoy the day together. Food will be served throughout the day, beginning with breakfast. That'll be prepared by Breakin Recovery from 8 to 10 in the small Ramada. A hot dog lunch will follow from noon to 1 p.m. in the large Ramada, with a pulled pork dinner served there at 5 p.m. Snacks and drinks will also be available for purchase between breakfast and dinner. The vendor market opens at 9 o'clock in the morning and will continue until 2 in the afternoon, offering visitors several hours to shop. All vendor spaces have already been filled, and organizers are not accepting additional vendors. Much of the morning will center on activities for children and families. The Bounce House opens at 9 a.m., although its hours are subject to change, and the Dog Parade begins at 10 o'clock a.m. Rock Painting, Kids Zone Games, and the Hay Bale Olympics are scheduled from 10 to 1 p.m. Vernon Express train rides will run from 10 to noon. Adults could join line dancing at 10:30 in the morning in the large Ramada before the afternoon shifts to the softball field. A warm-up scrimmage is scheduled from 1 to 2 p.m., followed by a game between VFD and Beacon Recovery from 2 to 4 p.m. Papa Joe and Daniel Highstone will provide live music from 4 to 6 p.m. in the small Ramada as the celebration moves into the evening. And after dinner, the fundraising activities will continue, with a homemade foods auction, a basket raffle drawings, and drawing for $525 Cal Ranch gift card. Organizers said enough items have already been pledged for the homemade foods auction and asked that no additional donations be brought to the park unless they were arranged for in advance. Tickets for the Cal Ranch gift card drawing are $10 for each or 6 for 50. Tickets are available in advance by contacting Paula at 928-892-2173 and will also be sold during Vernon Day. Ticket sales for the drawing and basket raffles at the park are scheduled from 8 a.m. to 5 o'clock in the evening. Paula, again, can be reached at 928-892-2193. And on to the Basin Roundup. Brace yourself for a good time. The annual back-to-school bash at the Sawmill Crossing Professional Plaza will return for its 12th year on Saturday, August 8th, hosted by Payson Orthodontics, Central Point Dental, and Eric Santana State Farm Insurance Agent. The event features free food, bounce houses, water slides, music, and a filling of fun for the whole family. Established in 2014 by Payson Orthodontics, the back-to-school bash has since grown to become an anticipated affair, and it attracts between 400 and 500 attendees each year. It also serves as an opportunity for local businesses to give back to the community, said Dr. Benjamin McDowell, the Payson Orthodontics owner. The very first year I was moving into that building, so I did a kind of a grand opening, he said. Dr. Flaherty at Centerpoint Dental and Eric Santana, they've been neighbors for all that time, they said, hey, that's awesome, let's do this block party every year. So what started as a grand opening event has turned into a block party and give back to the community type event. Besides kids' activities like water slides, bounce houses, and face painting, the businesses will be giving away shirts, balls, and assorted swag. Raffle items will include discounts on treatment at Centerpoint Dental. One of the things my office has done every year is we give away a braces scholarship, said McDowell. So some teenager in town will get full orthodontic treatment from us for free. He said that the scholarship is catered toward patients who otherwise wouldn't be able to afford the treatment. The braces scholarship will be awarded during the back-to-school bash. The people who come to the back-to-school bash, they're the ones who vote on the winner. It's not meant to be a popularity contest. We don't put out pictures and there are no names, said McDowell. He said that attendees will vote for their favorite finalists that are based on essays written by the anonymous applicants. The winner will be announced at the end of the event. The intent is that it's a little party. When you're back in school, let's have a little fun, said McDowell. It's just a good opportunity to give back to the community and have a good time. Payson police handled up to 1,326 total incidents in June, which works out to just one over incident every day for each of the 34 officers in the course of a month. This included 86 arrests. Of those, 64 were booked into jail, 18 got citations, and 4 juveniles were referred to juvenile court and then released. That comes out to about 1.3 incidents per officer per month, and 2.5 arrests per officer in the course of the month, assuming full staffing. Those arrests involved 7 domestic violence cases, virtually the only form of violent crime serious enough to trigger an arrest. However, only about 1 in 3 domestic violence calls resulted in an arrest. Officers also made 11 drug-related arrests, plus 8 drunk driving arrests, according to the June statistics, included in the town manager's report. The month's tally also included 16 theft-related arrests like burglary and shoplifting and 13 warrant arrests. Traffic stops remain the single most common activity for police, with 364 traffic stops resulting in 50 citations. And arrests for violent crimes remain vanishingly rare, with the exception of domestic violence. Police in June answered 19 domestic violence calls, which resulted in just 7 arrests. The list of calls included 20 cases of harassment and 1 case of abuse, in addition to cases listed as domestic violence. The monthly report includes some grim statistics in those calls. Police responded to 5 cases that involved dead bodies, 1 suicide attempt, and 5 suicide threats. Gila County has the second highest suicide rate in the state, according to the Arizona Department of Health Services. The rate of 61 completed suicides per 100,000 residents is about 3 times the state average. In part, that reflects the high rate at which suicide attempts in Payson involve guns. Payson, in 2025, had a violent crime rate of 284.5 per 100,000 residents. That's 12% below the national rate of 325.3 and 25% below the statewide rate of 337.3. This according to the FBI's Crime Data Explorer. Nationally, domestic violence accounts for 15% of violent crime and 20% of all homicides, according to the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence. 1 in 3 women and 1 in 4 men have been physically abused by a partner. Domestic violence accounts for about 50% of murders involving female victims. From Phoenix, Arizona voters can be asked to decide on a series of changes in state election laws in a take-it-or-leave-it ballot measure, a Maricopa County Superior Court judge has concluded. In a new ruling, Judge Adele Ponce acknowledged claims by the Tempe City Councilman Randy Keating that a proposal be put on the November ballot by Republican lawmakers has multiple provisions. These range from enshrining in the Arizona Constitution that only citizens can vote, something that's already in state law, to restrictions on spending by foreign nationals to influence elections, as well as setting up new procedures for tallying ballots at each polling place versus bringing them to a central location. And it would require all voters to show identification when casting a ballot, even those who vote by mail. Keating told the judge that the Arizona Constitution requires that voters should be allowed to consider each of those proposals separately. The key, he said, are court rulings which say that the Constitution itself requires that provisions in proposed amendments be sufficiently related to a common purpose or to a principle that can be said to constitute a consistent and a workable whole on the general topic embraced. By contrast, Keating said, what is being presented to voters deals with far-flung areas of the law, including voter qualifications, identification requirements, ballot tabulation, language giving lawmakers additional legal latitude in passing future election laws, and, perhaps most perplexingly, campaign finance. But Pont said it's not that clear or simple. She said the first test is whether all of the elements of the proposed constitutional amendment are topically related. Pont said everything in the measure fits within that legal box. Each aims to improve election integrity, the judge said. The fact that the proposed amendment's provisions address different aspects of election security does not prevent them from being topically related. That, however, isn't the sole deciding factor. Pont said there's also a requirement that the parts of a ballot measure are sufficiently interrelated, and here too, she said, what's in the package fits. They each directly address some aspect of election integrity, whether through requiring citizenship for voter registration, eligibility and financial influence, requiring government-posted identification prior to voting, providing the opportunity for ballot tabulation at the polls, or affirming the authority of the legislature to pass laws related to timely, accurate, efficient, or secure elections that promote public confidence, the judge said. And she said the fact that removing one provision wouldn't affect the rest is barely irrelevant, or legally irrelevant to whether they can be offered in a single package to voters. An appeal to the Arizona Supreme Court has already been filed. Keating said the issue is more than just about more than the number of different changes that the measure would make in an election law. He said the package is designed to deceive. For example, he cited the provision in the ballot measure about having to be a citizen to vote in state elections. That, said Keating, already is state law, having been approved by voters in 2004. These are things that are very clearly made to bait people into voting for a referendum in which they will then be taking away the rights and privileges that they've enjoyed, he said. And one of those, he said, is the right to vote by mail. Prior to 1991, that ability was limited to those with a special reason, like a disability or being away from a home voting precinct on that election day. This year, lawmakers approved no excuse early voting, and it has been proven popular, with more than 80% of the ballots being cast that way. Strictly speaking, the measure by itself would not outlaw early voting. But what it does include is the requirement to provide identification before casting any ballot, whether voting in person or by any other means. But there is nothing in the measure that says how someone voting by mail could accomplish that, leading to questions of whether that language, crafted by Representative Alexander Colden, is simply designed to kill off the practice. And it wouldn't be the first effort. Colden, the Republican nominee for Secretary of State, filed suit 4 years ago on behalf of Arizona Republican Party to ban voting by mail. In legal arguments, he cited a provision in the state constitution which says the ballot measures have to be approved or rejected by voters at the polls. At the time Arizona's constitution was ratified, it was obvious to the Arizona Supreme Court that the plain meaning of the polls did not include people's homes, but rather means designated polling places with the voting booths and the like, Colden argued. But his bid for a ruling in his favor was rejected by the Arizona Supreme Court. Keating said if the Supreme Court refuses to toss the measure off of the ballot, there will be a robust no campaign to convince voters to defeat it come November. And taking a look at letters to the editor, more notices being needed. I was walking my dog up the street from where I live on Miller Road, and I heard two gunshots. As I stooped to look around, I saw an abandoned house that had been waiting for demolition for about a year. It had a white vehicle with lights flashing in the driveway, and I witnessed about six men in green uniforms exit a dark vehicle. I was quite frightened by it and moved on quickly, but wondered if it was a drug bust evicting a squatter or possibly ICE. I found out the next day it was SWAT training and that they had had permission by the owner of the property to do this since the home was vacant. I was very surprised that there was no public notification that I could find. However, the neighbor across the street said was aware of what it was because she approached them and asked. So here's what I found online regarding whether or not the town has to notify neighbors. There are no specific town ordinances requiring the Payson Police Department to notify residential neighborhoods about SWAT or tactical training, as police training is considered an internal operational activity. However, standard department policy is to issue public advisories before training that involves loud bangs, blank ammunition, or high-visibility traffic gear to prevent public harm. Why do we not have an ordinance for this? If there is any kind of notification, where was it to be found? It was quite a frightening thing to witness in these times, and this was an ordinary residential neighborhood. And that was written by Kaya Kotzen, who lives in Payson. And another letter, the truth is not difficult to discover. One of the most troubling developments in today's political climate is the normalization of dishonesty. Too often, facts are replaced by rumor, distortion, and outright falsehoods. That style of politics has become closely associated with the MAGA movement, where loyalty sometimes appears more matter more than truth. I have personally experienced this. Two well-known local individuals repeatedly spread false statements about me. When I confronted each of them directly with evidence showing their claims were untrue, neither acknowledged the facts or apologized. Instead, they portrayed being confronted with the truth as if they were the victims. One example illustrates the problem. A local rumor monger searched public records until he found someone in another state who happened to have the same name as mine. That unrelated individual had assault charges. Despite knowing or having every reason to know that it was a different person, he circulated the story as though it referred to me. Another individual repeated the same falsehood. Even after the deception was exposed, neither corrected the record or apologized. The irony is that the truth is not difficult to discover. Anybody can examine public records and determine what is true and what is false, but doing that spoils the game. Falsehoods are far more useful to those who rely on character assassination than verified facts. Once a lie is repeated often enough, some people begin to accept it, even without checking for evidence for themselves. Healthy political debate depends on honest disagreement, not fabricated accusations. We can disagree about policies, candidates, priorities, but we should never accept lying as a legitimate political strategy. Our community deserves better. And that was written by Mike Quinn, who lives in Payson. And that's it for Northland Views. Mark DeGroft with you. Thanks for listening. Wallace Kleindienst will be back next week. Until then, take care.